It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Across the nation, early childhood education is more segregated than any other level of education. Those findings are from the Urban Institute. A new book captures the contrasts of two preschool classrooms in Madison, one attracting children from affluent families, the other children living in poverty. Call in with the question, add your perspective, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Casey Stockstill is an assistant professor of sociology at Dartmouth College. New book is called False Starts, The Segregated Lives of Preschoolers. Casey, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. It's great to be here.
Your book is the culmination of 2 years of your observations at two Madison area preschools. How did you come to spend so much time at these particular schools?
So my project started at one of the Head Start centers in Madison. And I actually intended to just go for a few months. I wanted to observe how children made sense of race and racial identity. And so I began observing in this Head Start classroom, and I kind of just got hooked on it because I think four-year-old kids have really interesting perspectives on inequality, on social life, and I feel like adults take those for granted. And so I continued observing in that Head Start classroom for 2 years and kind of developed themes about, well, how do these kids do pretend play? How do they engage with objects and toys in their classroom? How do they connect to friends and teachers? I ended up deciding to add a comparison case at a private center that I pseudonym Great Beginnings in the book. And I just did 1 month of observations there thinking, okay, I'll see a few contrasts. Maybe they'll do some of these routines a little differently. But it ended up being incredibly different. And so as I wrote up the book, kind of the organizing principle for it became segregation, class and race segregation, and how this matters for children and for teachers.
And what I think is so fascinating is that you're not just observing the classrooms, you're having conversations with these four-year-olds. I mean, there is back and forth. You're engaging with them. You're sitting alongside them, you know, outside, inside, in these different areas. How was that to be able to, just absorb yourself in their world in the classroom?
It was such a privilege to spend that time with kids. At the time, I did not have children. And so I was thinking more so about teachers who spend lots of time with kids, but they're very busy and they have to multitask and manage curricula, keep the kids safe, all of these tasks. So for me, coming in as an observer with no real agenda and just being able to take my time and play house with them, run around outside, it was such a privilege. And then now being a parent, it's kind of the same thing. Of course, I am interested in my kids and I want to do the best for them, but it's rare to just be able to spend hours and hours a day listening to kids. And that turned out to be really important because, you know, you can interview a 9-year-old or a 10-year-old child and kind of get their perspective, but 4-year-olds aren't. I actually tried interviewing them and it was a huge bust. 4-year-olds don't do that same kind of conversational turn. So it was really important to be there observing and just record their spontaneous thoughts about the classroom.
We're talking about American preschools and segregation with Dartmouth College Assistant Professor of Sociology, Casey Stockstill. You can join in with your questions along the way. Questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Casey, you describe both schools as being highly rated with these enriching routines for the kids, abundant toys, experienced teachers with small class sizes. How did these preschools become so segregated?
So that's a surprisingly complicated question. In the book, I talk about how we've had a template for preschool segregation since the 1870s in the United States. Preschool is a little different than K-12, right? Because it's not compulsory, and in most places, you're not guaranteed access to it. Instead, a lot of preschools are private. Although, you know, states like Wisconsin will offer a subsidy to try to allow poor families greater access to preschool. And so, the story of how they became segregated, well, some of it is about Head Start, because Head Start prioritizes children whose families are in poverty. So 90 to 100% of Head Start children are living in poverty. And then because there's, clustering of race and income in the United States, we see a disproportionate share of children of color in poverty and therefore in programs like Head Start. And then the school that I call Great Beginnings, that you can think of it as like a de facto segregation. So they weren't setting out to have classrooms that were majority affluent and white, but they were. It's an expensive program, so the tuition there is about 20% higher than the average in Madison. And they did accept the state subsidy, but they had no families using it when I was doing my research. So yeah, so it's kind of a story about, there's a historical trends that lead us to segregated preschools, but a lot of it is actually about how expensive and difficult it is, how difficult it is to find childcare and how expensive it can be.
The line you said, I think, is that at Great Beginnings, none of the students had parents in jail. What were some of the challenges that these kids at the Head Start program encountered in their daily life?
So I mean, if you just kind of think logically about conditions of poverty and conditions of structural racism, when you get 17 kids in one class who are facing those conditions, you see a higher incidence of these kinds of family hardships, I guess. So there were some kids who had a parent in jail or in prison. There were kids who were evicted, who had to move a lot. There were families in foster care, which, Head Start often prioritizes placement of children in foster care and homeless children as a way to meet these kids' needs, right? So you have that in the classroom. And a lot of these experiences I'm listing, homelessness, foster care, eviction, these happen more often to poor families and to families of color. And that was kind of normal to me. Spending those 2 years in Head Start, it was just like part of the landscape. There was also more diverse family structures. So you had single dads, single moms, grandparents raising children, married parents. And then I went to Great Beginnings and, wanted to kind of tabulate the family situations in those classrooms. And what was so striking to me is that all the kids had two married parents, except one kid whose parents were divorced. And that just stood out so much in that context that the teachers really worked to like normalize that for that child and for the rest of the class that, like, yeah, some families, some kids have parents who live in different places. But yeah, just a totally different family landscape at each center.
And with the poverty comes instability. And so you were observing classrooms where kids were coming in and out, and there was then the orientation of bringing a new child into the classroom. How did that affect the dynamics at Head Start compared to what you saw at the private preschool?
Great question. So this is something I think is maybe overlooked in preschool policy, especially for Head Start. Head Start wants to deliver an enriching classroom environment to the kids who need it the most. And so they do things, like I said, of prioritizing homeless children, children in foster care. They generally are 100% serving, 100% of their kids are in poverty, right? This creates a dynamic where there's transition in enrollment. And I do want to emphasize there was variety. So actually, two-thirds of the class was stably enrolled at Head Start. They were there in September and they stayed all the way to the end of the year, right? They would have parents who were in poverty, but who had the same job. Like maybe the mom had worked at Walmart for 5 years, or the mom was a home health aide, right? They were stably housed. So that's two-thirds of the class. But then about one-third of the class had fluctuating enrollment. Every time these transitions happen that involve moving, like eviction and foster care and homelessness, a kid might leave the classroom and a new kid would come in. And this really impacted teachers' time because they had to get to know these new children, orient them to preschool in general, or maybe just how they did things in their class. And so part of the job of teaching in this Head Start classroom was being in orientation mode all the time. And then I went to Great Beginnings, and I was there in the month of February. All the children had been enrolled since September. And this gave these teachers an advantage because they knew their children very well. They had oriented them to the classroom, and they did not have this kind of transition time of helping new kids adjust to their classroom.
Dartmouth College sociologist Casey Stockstill exploring the segregated lives of preschoolers in her new book called False Starts, focusing on two preschool classrooms in Madison for the research. Call in with a question. Bring your perspective to the discussion. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Dartmouth College Assistant Professor of Sociology Casey Stockstill analyzes segregation in preschools and the effects on learning. Her new book is called False Starts, and she spent 2 years observing children and staff of a Head Start program in Madison alongside a private preschool program in another part of the city. You can be part of the conversation at any point. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Casey, the Head Start school, the staff, the teachers were required to fill out more paperwork to keep track of the students' progress. They had to keep track of who ate at each meal and do teeth brushing and ensure, developmental screenings of children. How does this paperwork requirement affect how much time teachers can spend with children?
Yes, Kate, there is a lot of paperwork involved in Head Start, and some of it could be spread across the teachers. So in this classroom, there was a lead teacher who had a bachelor's degree in education and then had more experience. And so she was in charge of like Madison 4K curriculum paperwork, something called Gold Notes for the creative curriculum, and some of the intervention tracking that happened. And then there were two assistant teachers that could help with meal counts and teeth brushing. But what I observed is you can think of all these policy interventions we do on Head Start and on poor children. They come from good places, right? They're about giving a service or an experience to kids. But then policymakers want to track what happened. They want to know, they're hoping that their intervention made a difference, right? And so this paperwork gets layered on top of Head Start teachers and other teachers who teach poor children. Miss Roxanne, the lead teacher in the Head Start Center, didn't think this paperwork added much benefit. She said, it's taking me out of the classroom. I'm trained in how in developmentally appropriate practice. Like I know how to connect with my students and to help them, but instead of actually helping them, I'm spending all this time documenting everything that happened. So when I went to Great Beginnings, I was like, okay, well, what's the paperwork here? Because surely there's paperwork, and a lot of jobs have, odious paperwork that we hate doing. And there they didn't have most of the paperwork that happened at Head Start. They did do a lot of communicating to parents. They sent a weekly email. They wrote down if each child napped each day. They had a monthly newsletter. But I asked them, how do you feel about this paperwork? Is this super annoying to fill out? And they didn't feel that way. They liked doing it. They were very proud of the newsletters.
And the gold notes that you talked about, I mean, that is detailed. I think you said it, dozens of objectives that the teachers are required to write up during the school year on the children.
Yeah, it's something like 3 times a year for every child. They have to go through more than a dozen educational objectives and write just a little note saying, like, I saw Thomas jump with 2 feet. But it just multiplies when you have, many children.
Wisconsin lawmakers have debated how to address the shortage of daycare providers. How challenging is staffing public preschool programs like Head Start compared with staffing privately funded pre-K programs?
That's a good question. It seems like most preschools are dealing with the same staffing shortage. When I talked to the Head Start teachers, they were weighing all the factors of their job, right? So they said they enjoyed getting county benefits, like, the health insurance and the retirement. They liked the trainings that they got. They get a lot of support. Like, there's high support for the job that they do. However, it's a high stress job for them, and the paperwork is part of that, right? And if you compare it to schools like Great Beginnings that are private, it removes some of the paperwork. So teachers there felt, empowered or more trusted to manage curricula and to do lesson planning how they wanted to do it. But the pay is honestly not, it doesn't seem to be much better at private programs. So yeah, I think this staffing is something that all programs are thinking about, but I do think that we should think about segregation and workload and how that factors into teachers' decisions, for what program that could they can work at. Because programs are short-staffed, it's pretty easy to move from one preschool to another as a teacher. And based on my research, like some of these high stress aspects of serving a classroom of all, where all the children are in poverty, factor into teachers' decisions of how long to stay at that school.
In your surveying, Head Start teachers used words like chaotic, overwhelming, and bedlam to describe their classroom environment. What effect could those associations have on the climate in the classroom, for these kids?
Yeah, so they did they found the classroom stressful sometimes. I talk about in the book. So also there was absences that would happen at Head Start with the instability in families' lives. On a given day, maybe only 15 or 14 of the kids show up instead of the full 17. But the Head Start teachers still saw this as stressful. And I think that's important because it can become a characterization of the classroom as a whole, even when, from what I'm observing, there's like five or six kids that are acting in really challenging ways. They're adding a lot of stress for teachers. But then there's maybe 10 kids who are overplaying by themselves. They're relatively calm, right? And yeah, there's some quantitative research showing that a teacher's outlook on the kids that they serve affects the relationship that kids and teachers have. Just kind of like with parenting, right? Where if you feel stressed or irritated, you might bring that into the way that you engage with kids.
We're talking about preschool segregation with Dartmouth College sociologist Casey Stockstill. You can join in with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234, email ideas@wpr.org. Casey, for Head Start families in poverty, there's a little spare money to pay for field trips and other enrichment activities. How does this aspect shape the preschool experience for the children?
Yeah, so there were less enrichments at Head Start. Head Start does these family fun nights where they'll invite parents to come to the school. Sometimes they were educational, like about discipline or about language at home. Sometimes they were just fun, kind of like a carnival at the school. So Head Start is trying to engage with families in a low cost way, and add to families like positive experiences at school. And that, again, what spending 2 years there, I thought it was great. I thought it was normal. When I went to Great Beginnings to observe, I noticed a lot of engagement that I would call amenities focused. And so they had a monthly enrichment. It might be bringing in a magician to the school. It might be a field trip to the pumpkin patch. And they would ask families to pay, $5 or $10 for each of these experiences. So yeah, it just kind of a difference in the amount of like extracurricular activities happening inside the preschool day. And I saw more of that at Great Beginnings and less of it at Head Start.
And you also saw the show and tell moment where children could bring their experiences from vacation or things that they've done and tell the class about it. How did that contrast with Head Start?
This was really interesting. So, a whole chapter in the book is about children's quests to bring in personal objects to school. And this started for me at Head Start. It wasn't something I even had on my radar until I was observing in the classroom, and I noticed that there were kids, especially boys of color, that would try to sneak in like a Spider-Man toy or like a slimy sticky hand, a rock. But Head Start, they wanted to de-emphasize scarcity that some families were dealing with at home. So they had a rule that you couldn't bring in personal stuff from school. If the kids brought it and the teachers noticed, they would take it away and they would put it in this clear plastic bin during the school day. And their logic also was like, hey, we have a lot of classroom toys for everyone to enjoy. Just focus on those. And so with that rule of no personal stuff, the kids reacted in different ways. Two-thirds of the kids did not try to bring in personal stuff, but one-third of the kids, again, mostly boys of color, continued all year to try to sneak stuff in to school. And I talk about that as like encouraging a sense of constraint in these kids, a feeling that I have to check some of my personal self and my treasured objects, check that stuff at the door, and play with the kind of institutional objects at school.
We're going to
When I went to,
pause. I want to just
sorry.
pause right there. Dartmouth College sociologist Casey Stockstill will pick up this conversation. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Preschool classrooms are communities that draw together teachers, children, and families. Dartmouth College sociologist Casey Stockstill writes how they embody the village it takes to raise a child, but they're largely segregated environments. Her new book is called False Starts. It's about her years observing two preschools in Madison. Call in with a question, share your thoughts, 800-642-1234, email ideas@wpr.org. Casey, can you tell us about personal property and the items the kids brought at the Great Beginnings preschool, the affluent preschool, and what that allowed these kids to do to showcase the things they cared about from home?
Sure. Yeah. So as I mentioned, when I observed at Head Start, the children weren't supposed to bring in personal items, so some of them would sneak things in. When I went to Great Beginnings to see, as a comparison, I was looking for what kinds of toys will the kids sneak in here, and I was surprised to find that there weren't kids sneaking in objects, and that happened because Great Beginnings did show and tell. So they did a weekly show and tell with like a letter of the week, and the kids would use this to bring in things that they liked. Once a kid brought something in for show and tell, they could then put it in a play center and engage with it during the day. What was also interesting is some of the kids would find out they had the same item, right? Like there was the letter N was one of the weeks I observed, and several kids brought in like a Melissa and Doug brand wooden nail set. And so they'd find these points of common interest, but also just get to enjoy their items from home at school.
And they were able to present to the class in such a way that you said built their confidence. Was there something similar at the Head Start school?
Yeah, so at Great Beginnings with show and tell, they'd kind of hold it behind their back, shuffle to the front of the class, and then they display it and talk about it with their peers. And I talk about that as celebrating personal property. Sunshine Head Start did not have show and tell, so they didn't get that opportunity, but also they did fewer of these moments of having one child stand up in front of the class and talk about something in their life.
Let's take a call now. Angela is with us in Pardeeville. Angela, hi.
Hi, good morning. I missed the first part, so I hope I'm not touching on something that you already touched on. But I go into some Head Starts and some daycares, and I find it frustrating that in my school district, they want to close the achievement gap at the high school level. And I strongly feel that in order to do that, they need to invest in these children, the 3 and 4, or maybe even younger children, to build their skills as they go into the school system to build their academic and pre-academic skills. And those three words that you said to describe the Head Start classrooms, I totally, or some of the teachers said, I completely agree with that. I've been in Head Start classrooms where I'm stressed. I was in one that I felt was unsafe. A child was running around, climbing on everything, pushed a bookshelf towards a circle time where children were sitting. So I find it frustrating that the people, the teachers at Head Start and the TAs who are supporting the neediest of the needy kids are paid the least as educators, it seems.
Angela, thank you for the call. Casey, what do you make of those observations?
It sounds like some of the stuff that I saw at Head Start, and I want to emphasize that I thought the teachers were fantastic at Head Start. I think they did exactly what they should have done with the group of kids that they have. But I think most of them would agree with this. It we're asking too much of preschool teachers when we segregate by social class, especially, and say you need to help 17 children, a third of whom are dealing with traumas of poverty at home, and they're bringing that into the classroom. And I think, you know, there is really good research showing that preschool can have a huge impact, especially for children in poverty. But what I wondered through my research is, could we have even more of a positive impact if we funded preschool in a way that kind of spread out children of all social classes across many different preschools, right? So ask the Great Beginnings teachers to consider and support kids in poverty as well as affluent children, and kind of create similar scenarios at places like Head Start.
And in the years you observed the Head Start, you said you never saw a teacher engage in an open conversation with a child about a family challenge that they were encountering. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, so this surprises some people, especially because I think there's a kind of social media conversation about generational trauma and just talking openly to kids. And I think these teachers are aware of those conversations. But at Sunshine Head Start, there was this fear among teachers that if they had extended conversations with kids about family hardship, like maybe a kid mentions that they don't have milk at home, or the lights weren't on last night, right? Teachers felt like if I dig too much into this, it will seem like I'm prying. And it might also put them in a position to have to consider making a report about neglect to Child Protective Services. And so I think in general, this kind of specter of Child Protective Services that poor families deal with, and also teachers in higher poverty schools deal with, closed off moments for conversation that the kids were bringing up. Like the kids were kind of mentioning things happening at home, and there's a feeling of like kind of silencing of those details.
I wonder, as you engaged in play and had conversations with the children, how did you see some of these struggles from home emerge in how you interacted with them, like in play centers, for instance?
So this was interesting because I think as adults we have the broader context on hardships that poor kids are facing, and we just see them as, you know, completely bad, and they are bad. But for children, sometimes they bring up facts at home just kind of as facts of life. So, you know, I'd play in the house area with kids, and they would in their play enact, the lights are off, so we can't go to my house, or I don't have any milk, can I come to your house and get some milk? Putting people in jail, chasing kids as if they were cops and someone being chased, you know? So I did see some kind of really matter of fact enactments of family life.
Dartmouth College sociologist Casey Stockstill with us on her research regarding preschool segregation. New book is called False Starts, and you can join in with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Casey, we heard from Samantha in Whitehall called in, and Samantha is wondering if there's research on how kids in preschool age interact with others who have disabilities or autism or immobilities, and how do the teachers at preschools interact?
I'm not sure. There could be research on this, and I'm not aware of it, but I like the question because this is another aspect of segregation and inclusion. I think these debates are more explicit in pre-K though. So, you know, there's a movement toward broader inclusion in schools, and the idea that to the extent possible, we should include kids with disabilities in all kinds of classroom settings. However, it's, you know, teachers need training to support kids with disabilities, and they sometimes don't get it, especially if they're teaching in a private center. And so you see clustering, I think, of kids with disabilities in Head Starts and in specialized programs that feel trained to support these children.
How did Head Start become a program that enjoys so much bipartisan support among lawmakers in Washington?
So Head Start is popular as an anti-poverty policy because, you know, Head Start started in the 1960s. It was part of Johnson's War on Poverty. And that was, you know, coming out at a time where we had emerging research on brain development and child development showing that early childhood is this critical period, and that the more, you know, exciting and interesting, you know, stimuli that kids are exposed to, the more it develops their brain and their capacity to learn and enjoy life later on. And so over the years, Head Start's had some really promising effects on educational achievement, especially up till third grade. And then it gets kind of messy as kids enter middle school and high school. But now we have these data on kids who did Head Start in the 60s and the 70s, and now they're adults and they're, you know, experiencing some boost to like adult earnings and just positive social experiences. So I think that's why it has bipartisan support, is if we think about, we have limited funds to spend on reducing poverty, Head Start is a pretty good investment.
And, you know, you called it the whole child approach of Head Start, that so many different aspects of the child is supposed to be addressed in Head Start. But you also told us, you know, just about the side effect of that is what you called whole family surveillance. You know, what can you say there to that?
Yeah, so this is a pretty kind of critical thing to say, but Head Start, for since its inception, has been about giving like a whole child, whole family support. They recognize that if they're going to serve children well, they need to help families with housing, with jobs. They need to think about kids and their health, their physical health, their emotional health, their learning. And so that all sounds really positive, and it can be. But the flip side is we see some of the kind of surveillance that poor families experience in other spaces. It comes into Head Start, you know, so Head Start gets a lot of information about families' work, families' income, what's happening for kids. And that means that Sunshine Head Start families have less choice about how much to kind of share about their family life. And I want to contrast that with places like Great Beginnings, where basically your affluence buys you the privilege of privacy. You can decide that your kid's going to be absent, and you don't need to tell the school why. You don't need to tell the school if you're unemployed, right? As long as you're paying your tuition, it's kind of none of their business.
And Head Start teachers meet with parents, and there is a push, you say, to meet in the child's home, in that home setting. What did you find there?
Yeah, so Head Start does this thing called home visits, where twice a year they want to do a home visit in the family's environment, if possible, to build connection. That's the intention of it. At least at the time of my research, the social worker said that they would do the first visit in the family's home. But after that, they'd say, hey, let us know if you want to do it at a park or at the preschool, we can do that instead. And she said that most families would opt for the second visit to not be in the home. And I think that makes sense, given kind of, again, the broader experience that many poor families have of worrying that outsiders will judge their parenting, that, you know, they'll find their parenting lacking and kind of judge it. And so, yeah, it's an interesting way that Head Start, federally, Head Start's trying to mandate engagement with families, but it kind of falls short, I think.
Dartmouth College sociologist Casey Stockstill studies how race and class matter in daily life. New book, False Starts, focuses on segregation in preschools with observations from two preschools in Madison over 2 years. Still time to talk. Call in with a question or comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A new book examines preschool segregation and effects on the education children receive before kindergarten. Dartmouth College sociologist Casey Stockstill observes two preschools in Madison. Her 2 years of interacting with children inform her insights into how preschool could be reimagined. Call in with a question, add your views, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Casey, you are an advocate of universal preschool for four-year-olds. How could universal preschool be an alternative to the segregated system that is now in place?
So I think universal preschool would help a lot, or could help a lot, in reducing especially the income segregation that we see. There are many families who are middle income, right? So they're not qualifying for childcare subsidies, but they also can't pay the high fees at some of the private centers. And so they're not represented in preschools. But if we expand access to preschool so that children of all incomes can go, that gives us an opportunity to make more class integrated spaces. It's also something that would be positive, for families and for employers.
Why can't all children attend preschool now?
Basically, because funding and slots are limited. And, in some ways, Wisconsin's doing really well here, and Madison in particular, Madison's creation of 4-year-old kindergarten opens up some seats for kids, but we need many options for families to be able to engage in preschools, right? Some families need a full day of childcare and they need preschool to roll into that. And sometimes the hours at like a public school based 4K classroom don't work for them. So there's about 70% of 4-year-olds attend preschool. And so that 30% that's not going, there's always some of them that their families are preferring to educate them at home and wouldn't send them. But the data do show that there's need that exceeds the available seats. And so we need to build more preschool classrooms and more preschool options for families.
How can that affect their education later on in life if they don't attend preschool?
So preschool, it can help kids get ready for kindergarten in the sense of being used to a group learning environment, being prepared to engage positively with peers, having those social and emotional skills that, I feel like the conversation toward that has really shifted and become more clear in the pandemic, the importance of kids being able to relate to others, regulate their emotions and their bodies. And so when kids attend preschool, teachers often really focus on social emotional skills and also the pre-literacy and the pre-math skills that help children fully engage and fully learn when they're in elementary school.
How much of a national conversation is there? How concerned are advocates of an expanded or universal preschool system about addressing the issues of segregation that we see now in preschools today?
So actually, I feel that segregation in preschool is under discussed, tremendously under discussed. And I think it's because, again, we have an access problem. So for me to talk about, the challenges of segregated classrooms, families who are just trying to get their child into any preschool don't necessarily have the appetite to think about, tweaking those preschools their kids can't even get into. And so because a lot of preschool advocates are at this moment of, we need expansion, we need more programs, we need better funding. There's a lot less discussion on segregation as something that we should deal with or we should address as we expand preschool.
How significant is the race of a child's classroom teachers to their development?
That's a good question. I'm not sure how much research exists on preschoolers and the race of their teachers. I know there's research about elementary and middle schoolers and the positive value that it can add for kids of color to have a teacher that looks like them and is responsive to them. I will say that in my research, all the teachers were white at both schools. And I actually went into it again to try to study how children make sense of race and identity, but I found a lack of conversation about race or cultural identity, even in Sunshine Head Start, which was it was all kids, mostly kids of color, but it was racially diverse. I think, this could be improved by just teachers of any race being more open about talking about family race or family culture in preschool.
You also found that teachers of color are overrepresented in classrooms, but in assistant or aid roles and underrepresented as the lead teacher role. What is preventing more people of color in the field of early childhood education from, being a lead teacher in the classroom or in administration offices?
Oh, yes, I'm glad you brought that up. So there's kind of a pipeline issue, like we see in many fields. There's a move in preschool and childcare, to push for quality, and that often includes a standard that the lead teacher should have a bachelor's degree and continuing education. And obviously it's expensive, and it costs time and money to go and get a bachelor's degree, especially for these working professionals. So we have a lot of early childhood educators of color who've been in the field for a long time. They know what they're doing. They know child development. But it's a tough sell to ask them to, at their own expense, go back to school, finish that bachelor's degree just to qualify to do the job they're basically already doing. So yeah, there's that education barrier. And then we also see an underrepresentation of people of color as administrators and center directors. And part of that is because, again, there's the education and credential issue, but also the capital. So a lot of these private schools, they're basically small businesses, and the center director is managing a small business and all the elements of early childhood education. You know, so you'll need that capital to kind of start and continue running a childcare center.
I want to refocus on the kids for a moment here. Do you miss the kids you studied and wonder what happened to them?
I do. Yeah, I do. What was tough about my study is I knew them so well in the classroom, but I didn't get to know their parents as well. Mm-hmm. And you know, 4-year-olds, they can't email me. They couldn't like text me, and so there's a few that I kept in touch with the parents, so I'm able to know about them. But most of the kids, I didn't stay in touch with the parents, and so I don't actually know how they're doing.
Mm. You also implemented what you called the least adult approach in your observations. And how did you get to gain that trust and that openness among the kids?
So the least adult approach, it's something other qualitative researchers with children have used. And this means that I'm not going to pretend that I'm a child. That would be really creepy, right? but I'm going to acknowledge that I have more power and authority because I'm an adult. But my goal is to be the least authoritative adult in the room. So at both places, you know, I wouldn't scold the children. I wouldn't tell on them. I also wouldn't help them in teacherly type of ways. So like if they skin their knee, I would point them to a teacher. And over time at Head Start, I think the kids relaxed around me, and they would, you know, break a classroom rule or gossip or show me the object they snuck into school in ways that they wouldn't with the teachers. And I think that makes my observations better. It gives my data more validity.
I also just want to end on that note. We only have a few seconds left, but you stayed with them during nap time and were able to listen to them in a real quiet environment as well. And I imagine that created connection.
Yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm. It did. Seeing them through all parts of their day, eating, playing, sleeping, the little things they whisper, you know, as they're about to fall asleep. It was a really special opportunity.
Casey, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for sharing your research.
Thank you so much. It was great to be here.
Casey Stockstill is an assistant professor of sociology at Dartmouth College and author of the new book, False Starts: The Segregated Lives of Preschoolers. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.